And hello and welcome to Writers on Writing on 88.9 KUCI FM. We're broadcasting from the University of California, Irvine campus, and on the web at kuci.org. We're somewhere else. iTunes, College Radio. Today's Wednesday, May 8th, 2013. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett, and today, for the entire hour, I have my friend Judith Schwartz with us. Judy is a longtime freelance writer whose work has appeared in venues from Glamour and Redbook to the Christian Science Monitor and the New York Times. She's the author of several books, including Tell Me No Lies, How to Face the Truth and Build a Loving Marriage, and The Therapist's New Clothes. She has an MA in Counseling Psychology and an MS from the Columbia Graduate School of Journalism. She lives with her family in southern Vermont, and she's here today to talk about her new book, her very new book, Cows Save the Planet, and Other Improbable Ways of Restoring Soil to Heal the Earth, published by Chelsea Green. Hi, Judy.
Hi, Barbara.
Great to have you. I'm so glad to have you here to talk about this book. So let's start with you talking about how it came about, and the long version is fine.
Oh, you want me to go into it? Anyway, I was thinking about this, and I was remembering a couple of years ago when I was really, really excited about all the things that I was learning about soil and about how by restoring soil you could solve, you could get at so many key problems. And you said, Judy, you need to do a book on this. Do you remember that?
No, I don't.
Oh, my gosh, we were at the Algonquin Hotel. Anyway, I remember my response then was, oh, no, then I need to be, you know, because I thought I had to would have to be lyrical about soil, and that isn't where I was going with it. But basically, the story is that I started, as a reporter, you never know where you're going to go. You never know what questions become so compelling for you that you need to, that you feel the need to pursue them. And I started writing about new economics because when the economy tanked in 2008, I started asking questions like, what is money? What is wealth? And that led me to environmental economics. And that led me to soil because I went to a conference, actually the Slow Money, there's something called the Slow Money Alliance, and their conference, I'd written a piece about them for Time.com. about that movement, which is about bringing money down to earth, literally, about keeping money in the that how money moves too fast, so it doesn't do any work on the ground. It doesn't work for communities. So it's about investing in small and medium-sized food enterprises in communities. So I went to this conference because it happened to be not far from me, which, since I live in the middle of nowhere, is pretty exciting when that happens. It was up in Shelburne Farms in Vermont. And a speaker, a fellow named Will Rapp, who founded Gardener's Supply and does all kinds of amazing nonprofit-type work, he gave a talk about soil. You know, I'm thinking, oh, yeah, this is going to be a snooze. And then he said how, over time, more CO2 has gone into the atmosphere from agricultural practices, basically, that, you know, being emitted from the soil, like the carbon comes from the soil, than from the burning of fossil fuels. And my antenna woke, you know, just, you know, went buzz. Just, that's really important. Then why are we all, I mean, I know why we're worried about too many about fossil fuels, but if there's another way that we can start to approach this problem of climate change and excess CO2 in the atmosphere, well, I mean, why don't we do it? So that's when I started exploring different means of restoring soil and all the multiple benefits that you get from it. Because what was exciting to me is that when you embarked on various sorts of regenerative agricultural practices, not only would you sequester carbon, because that was carbon that wanted to be in the soil from the beginning, but it just, because of the way that the land was treated, it oxidized and formed CO2 in the atmosphere. So not only would you address that, but you would bolster soil fertility. You would have healthier food because the soil was functioning better. And you would store more water, which means that floods would be less of a problem, because flooding happens when water hits dry earth or dry surfaces. So this just kept going on and on, and I got really excited about it.
And then somehow Chelsea Green found you, I think.
Yes, and that was kind of magic. Okay, so I wrote my first piece on this topic, and you know, just one thing that's worth saying on a show about writing is, wow, we need smart editors, we need receptive editors, because a lot of times you need to try out ideas, and I've been so lucky that I've had editors that have let me do that. I had a wonderful run with Time and Time.com, where literally I would get an inkling of an idea, and I just had a really good means of communication with my editor, someone named John Curran, and he would let me try out these things, and we got to the point where, I mean, he was barely touching my pieces, because I just knew how to write these stories, and they were really pretty challenging ideas for a company like Time. Things like challenging, is the GDP the best measure of prosperity, for example? You know, I mean, actually, it might not be as edgy now, but 4 years ago it was. So anyway, Pacific Standard, my editor, Michael Todd, was willing to let me explore soil restoration as a means of dealing with excess CO2, and I wrote that piece, and after that piece came out, Conservation Magazine asked me to build on that piece, and that piece became a profile of Alan Savory. I will talk about him in a minute, and then Chelsea Green wrote to me. Chelsea Green, I talk about it. It sounds like that's a person. It's not a person. I know a lot of people, when I say my book is with Chelsea Green, oh, who's that? Chelsea Green Publishing is a publishing company actually up here in Vermont in White River Junction. They wrote to me. They wondered if I might consider writing a book about Alan Savory, and I said, I just don't think I could do him justice, because it would require a lot of time spent in Zimbabwe, etc. I said, but I've been thinking a lot about soil, and that's how it happened.
Oh, that's funny. Well, this is, I mean, it's not funny. It's just interesting because so much of our talk has been around fiction and memoir. And I knew about all of these articles always, but and when this book came about, I thought, wow, she really is into it. This is very cool.
Well, it's a funny thing. Like many of us, there are many sides to me. And one is the fiction, memoir, lyrical stuff. And then the other is a pretty dogged journalist, just really just determined to find out why, just determined to go deeper once I get my teeth in a story.
You are listening to Writers on Writing on 88.9 KUCI FM in Irvine. I'm here with Judith Schwartz. Her book is Cows Save the Planet, published by Chelsea Green. So how did you then, you know, backing up even more, segue from the types of magazines you were writing for, you know, women's magazines and such, to environmental writing?
Okay, well, the women's magazines, that was actually, for me, a long time ago. And, freelancing from Vermont, how do I explain this? Well, I've done a lot of different things. Okay, so I got my clinical degree. Here, this is the narrative that I'll follow, because we've got a lot of squiggly lines that I could try to drag you along, and I don't want to do that. So I got a degree in counseling psychology. We moved to Vermont, and I had a series of experiences that I wrote about in the book called The Therapist's New Clothes, and that's a memoir about training as a therapist and a look at the seductions of psychotherapy. And I was seduced by psychotherapy. And to make a long story short, basically, I was kind of pulled deeper into exploration of what was going on in my psyche when it turned out that what I really needed was a biochemical tune-up. So I wrote that story. So I brought that book out myself.
And you were on this show with that book.
Absolutely.
Yes.
Absolutely.
Okay.
And I was very pleased with the book and et cetera, et cetera. It means a lot to a lot of readers, and I'm continually hearing all about that. But what the significance that writing that book ended up having was that I was able to put all that behind me, that it was done, that phase was over. I could look outward. And as I started to look outward, I started getting interested in politics, just reading about the environment, trying to understand how all things fit together. I started writing op-eds, some for the local paper, then I just tried out that voice, or more than a voice, it was tried out that vehicle, because I felt that's the way I wanted to engage with the world. And yeah, that's basically how it happened. And then just the more space there was in my own head, the more that I went down that road.
Mm.
And that led to environmental writing, because that's kind of what we're dealing with now.
Mm-hmm.
It's a pretty big part of our lives, our future, our fortunes.
Yeah, and environmental writing too. In terms of writers breaking in, it seems that there are so many venues now for science writing, environmental writing, so many magazines in print and online, where writers who are interested in journalism and want to break in, that's a great place to break in, and a necessary way to break in, I think.
Definitely. Well, two things are happening. Unfortunately, some big news outlets are actually cutting staff on this beat. But you're right that there are more of these vehicles coming up. And one really hopeful sign is that a publication, it was a startup called Inside Climate News, they just won a Pulitzer.
Mm-hmm.
A tricky thing is that many of these venues are very low-paying, but again, when you break in and build your clips, etc., a lot of people care about these matters. So go for it.
Mm.
And look for stories that aren't out there, because that's what I found. Basically, I found that there were all these aspects to our environmental predicament that weren't getting discussed. And it actually was much more, what I was finding was much more optimistic than what I was hearing in the media.
Mm-hmm.
And for a while, when I kept finding all these amazing things about soil improvements and the role of soil in all of our ecological systems and how we could basically kind of come in at any point on the cycle and work toward restoration, for a while I was kind of sitting back and saying, well, I wonder when someone's going to finally do a book about this. And, well, it didn't happen. And then Chelsea Green, or I didn't see anything. And then Chelsea Green contacted me, the publisher contacted me, and it was, okay, Judy, it's time. No one else is doing it. You do it.
Oh, I love it. I love stories like this. And I would love to hear you read from Cows Save the Planet. Would you do that?
Okay. Yes, I will. And first, I want to preface this by saying to listeners, no, my intent is not to lead you to despair, because in this chapter, it turns greatly, okay?
Okay.
But this is just the introduction. This is from a chapter called The Return of Lost Water. The weather's been awfully weird. I write this in southern Vermont in early March 2012, a day after the temperature climbed above 60 degrees, and I wore a t-shirt when I walked the dog up the mountain road. Last night we had terrific winds, the limb-clipping kind, which after dark whipped into a rainstorm punctuated by the occasional crackle of ice and hail. This in a winter during which one January afternoon I changed my boots in an eerily empty Prospect Ski Mountain Lodge as the owner and cook stared drop-jawed at the weather channel. Nothing but too warm weather and rain as far out as they could predict. Rain in January? It's been the worst cross-country ski season anyone at Prospect has ever seen. The high school Nordic team, which my son competes on, has been roaming the county, desperate for skiable snow. Actually, the weather's been weird pretty much since I moved here 15 years ago. Our first spring, there was the tornado that rode Route 67A through North Bennington and across the Bennington College campus where we then lived. The sky turned pickle green, and I curled up on the couch to wait it out. The minute the wind stopped, 100 chainsaws broke into song, the neighbor-helping-neighbor sound of vigilante road clearing. Last summer brought us Hurricane Irene, which left more than a dozen Vermont towns with no roads in or out for days. From our spot on the mountain, I thought it was just a regular old storm until we got our power back and via Facebook shared witness to covered bridges collapsing and cars swimming in parking lots. Everyone's got similar stories these days. The heat waves are hotter, the hurricanes heavier, the lack of snow more lacking. The extreme and unusual, what weather pros call 100-year events, are now extreme yet usual. Meanwhile, our political candidates are asked if they believe in climate change, as if it matters what any of us thinks. Unless we willfully choose not to, and many do, we all know that the weather has meandered far from its familiar patterns, that it's gone off kilter, and that this likely has something to do with what we've been doing to the planet. In news reports about extreme weather events, it's become de rigueur for the reporter to ask some highly credentialed authority in that blithe tone of offhand curiosity we favor in our newscasters whether this heat wave, rash of tornadoes, relentless wildfire season is a consequence of global warming. And the expert, no doubt mindful of the job-threatening controversy that could erupt upon connecting too many dots, will say something along the lines of, well, of course it is hard to attribute any particular occurrence to global warming, but the statistics are showing a clear trend toward intensified storms, warming, instability, that is consistent with the model of global climate change. And then perhaps we'll hear a vague analysis of the jet stream configuration or ocean currents, all in a matter-of-fact voice, a manner that offers some reassurance that nothing too disturbing is going on and that the experts have it all under control.
Thank you. That was Judy Schwartz reading from Cows Save the Planet and Other Improbable Ways of Restoring Soil to Heal the Earth. Excuse me, published by Chelsea Green. How much then did you know about the topic before you took it on? I mean, you were writing a lot about it, and you knew to some extent, but when Chelsea Green approached you, did you have to then do more research to show them that you could indeed do it, or did you know enough that they said, just go for it?
At that point, I had been doing a lot of my own research. I'd really been building a kind of, I don't want to say file, but I guess I could say computer files on notes that I was taking about soil. And part of that was I had applied for a couple of different grants, which I didn't get, but I had some material in my mind. I was beginning to categorize, like, the soil-water connection, soil and health, soil and climate. So I was beginning to do that. When I went to them, we had a really... I went up to their offices, which are about 2 hours away from me. We had a really wonderful animated conversation, and it was so exciting as a writer to sit in a room with people who understood exactly what you had been doing, even though you had been doing that in solitude while sitting at your desk reading articles on the computer and watching videos. Okay, so that was really, really wonderful. And working with them has been so different from my other publishing experiences. You know, I just think back on selling other books. I don't know if you've had this experience, but, you know, or maybe it says more about me than anything, but I feel like I kind of, you know, have to present myself as like some, you know, like that there's some model of journalist author that I had to fit some template to please them or something, but this was different. This was just, this is what I'm thinking about, this is what I think is important, this is why I think it's important, and I didn't even have to make any arguments. They totally got it. Then, okay, I remember this very, very well. So we all had the ideas, and then I said, so I'm trying to remember who said it first. I just don't know the structure. I just don't know how I would lay out this book. And they said, well, yes, that's your job to tell us. And then I remember saying, oh, somehow I thought that you would know that. So, I mean, it was a really funny moment. Like, okay, yeah, now what? So the publisher, Margot Baldwin, said that she would like me to write a proposal that would clearly lay out how I would approach this book. And I said, gosh, this is, you know, knowing that what a tough job this was, I mean, indeed it is the tough job of writing a book, basically, of knowing what it is that you're going to, of conceptualizing and planning it. I said, do you have any models, books that you would like me to think, just that books of this type that have worked? And they sent me home with a pile of Chelsea Green books, and the other one that she mentioned was The Omnivore's Dilemma.
Hmm.
Have you read that book?
No,
I mean,
I haven't.
Okay. Anyway, it's really, really good. So I read pieces of it, and I went home and I read it again and just thought, great, so I'm supposed to do something like this, huh? And anyway, what I did was I wrote an initial chapter, which touched upon all the topics, and a chapter outline, and they said, let's do it.
Hmm. Just like that.
Well, yeah. I mean, this was
that's
a courtship.
Great. Yeah, that's
process.
Great.
Yeah, I laid out what the voice would be,
mm-hmm.
and what I would be covering, and they knew that I had the connections in the world of environmentalism, the scientists. They knew I could do that.
Speaking of voice, and then we're going to take a real short break. One thing I like about this book so much, and one thing I do like about books like this, and what prompts me to read lay science books or books that are important, is the voice. And you know, you've used your voice. You are writing the way you write your fiction. I mean, yeah, maybe you're not as lyrical, but you are sort of, and it works. You know, it's very pleasant, and I very much, you know, feel you in all of the sentences, and that's a wonderful thing.
Well, thank you so much. And that, knowing the question of whether I would be able to pull that off, that was what hit me while I was sitting in that room. Oh, wait a second, I have to write a book. It's not just that I'm going to tell you all these, like, things that I'm really excited about. Oh, yeah, I have to write it in a way that is giving, is in relation to the reader.
Mm-hmm.
So that was it. That was the challenge.
Mm. Well, we're going to take a very short break, so all of you out there, stay with us, and we'll be right back with more Judith Schwartz and Cal Save the Planet. Don't go anywhere.
Come back, baby, please don't go. No, I love you, darling, hate to see you go. Come back, baby, let's talk it over one more time. My heart's full of sorrow, mama aching tears. Be gone 24 hours, child, seem like 1,000 years. Come back, baby, let's talk it over one more time. Darling, one month better than a day. Let's talk it over before you go away. Come back, baby, let's talk it over one more time.
Hello, this is Claudia Shambaugh, your host of Ask a Leader, airing on Tuesday mornings from 9 until 10. Join me as we explore the worlds of leaders of all stripes, of all ages, from all realms of our society. These leaders may be voted into office, appointed, anointed, or volunteers. We'll examine them all in this show. Subjects include politics, government, religion, human rights, culture, physical and mental health, and more. We'll find leaders in places the rest of us aren't even looking.
Yeah, the dirt on publishing, writers, authors, all of it. Listen.
The views and opinions expressed on this program do not necessarily represent those of KUCI, its management, or the UC Board of Regents. For more information on this or other KUCI programs, visit kuci.org or kucitalk.org.
And welcome back to Writers on Writing on 88.9 KUCI FM. We're broadcasting from the University of California, Irvine campus and on the web at kuci.org and iTunes College Radio. And I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett, and I've been here since the beginning of the hour with Judith Schwartz. Her book is Cows Save the Planet and Other Improbable Ways of Restoring Soil to heal the earth. I was going to say to hear the earth, which I suppose is part of it too, huh?
Yeah.
I don't know. Anyway, so something you were talking about in the last part, let me just look, the format, the structure of the book brings me to format. And I was curious on a purely technical level. Throughout the book, there are some sort of sidebars or screened boxes of side information. And I wondered if that was your idea or their idea. Like on 93, old water paradigm versus new water paradigm.
Right. That was my idea. And it wasn't necessarily in conversation with them. They let me do my thing. And there were some pieces of the content that I thought were important, but that didn't necessarily fit in the narrative.
Mm-hmm.
I hope that works.
I like little sidebars like that.
I know a lot of people do, but we were kind of wondering whether we should try to tuck them in or not. Mm. And I just said, we agreed it was fine.
Well, the other thing that they do is they break it up. You know, when there's, you know, text on every page, it's like visually it breaks it up along with subtitles and everything else. But, you know, I thought they were a good addition. And I liked how you started chapters with quotes. I like that, too.
Mm-hmm. Those quotes were fun to find.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You could probably lose days looking for quotes and happily do so and keep you away from the writing. I'm just going to find quotes today.
Yeah.
Another question, and I was really curious about this in reading your book, and that was that, I don't know who made me aware of this or who complained about this years ago, but, with cows overgrazing, I think I was in Colorado, and somebody from there was complaining about cows overgrazing some of the mountains and all the methane and all that. And you address that in the book to a degree. And I wonder if you would talk about that from the point of view of, I guess it's not such a bad thing.
Right. Cows have been maligned greatly. And the reason that the book is called Cows Save the Planet, okay, two reasons. One is, this is a book about soil. And I couldn't come up with a book that had soil and a title that had soil in the title that didn't sound like a yawn. So I decided to go with something provocative. Okay. The other reason it has that title is this is a nod to Alan Savory's work. And he's the fellow that I mentioned earlier that Chelsea Green wanted me to, or was wondering if I would be game to, actually, that's a joke. Sorry, it's all about wild animals. If I'd be willing to write a book about him. Okay. Alan Savory developed something called holistic management. It's a decision-making framework that's used in the context of animal management so that livestock are used as tools for large-scale land restoration. Now, that sounds technical. Let me explain. He was a young wildlife biologist and game park ranger in Zimbabwe, then Rhodesia, and he loved animals, and it was heartbreaking to him to watch the land deteriorate and the wildlife begin to disappear. This was of great concern to him, and he was lamenting this, you know, terrible development, and it occurred to him that, well, first of all, that when they took animals, when they tried to rest the land, when they took animals and people off land, that the land got worse. So here, this was supposed to solve the problem, it made it worse. And so he realized that the land was much healthier when there were those huge herds of grazing animals, whether they were water buffalo or giraffe or antelope, all those different kinds of animals, that the land was healthier when they were present. And so it occurred to him that perhaps the land needed the animals as much as the animals need the land.
Mm.
So by managing livestock in a way that mimics the behavioral patterns of these wild grazing herbivores, which they had in Africa and certainly in this country, and that it could restore the land. And there's been a lot of work, a lot of research on this, and it can be done. I mean, it's actually about the most exciting thing out there in terms of restoring our ecosystems. Okay, so that's one thing, but I do want to get to the methane because I know that's very much in everybody's mind.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, sometimes that's the first thing that someone says to me, like, oh, I thought that cows caused global warming. All right, when we look at these figures about methane, yes, cattle produce methane, we're not looking at the methane cycle. We're not looking at the production of methane via livestock in the context of the methane cycle. In well-managed land that has the diversity of life forms, animals, healthy soil, a lot of plants, etc., it's in balance. But so just as an example, when you have functioning soil, like soil with a lot, like soil is alive. There's a, like in one teaspoon of soil, of healthy soil, there are maybe 6 billion little tiny microbes and fungi and little tiny things. Okay, so soil is very much alive. So in living soil, one kind of bacteria subsists on methane. So methane gets produced, it gets consumed, it moves through plants, it moves through animals. So when things are in balance, there's not a methane problem. Now, methane becomes a problem in the context of livestock when you have, like, feedlots and a lot of manure being stored in, like, lagoons in kind of water, and then it's out of control. So it's not cattle per se. It's how they're managed.
Right. That's a really interesting point, and I'm so glad but I know it now because, no, really, because I've been holding on to this for years. And so much of the problem, as you're talking about, is the management.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. And looking at things holistically.
Mm-hmm.
Because often we look at one piece of the story. Just well, like, for, okay, all right, so maybe I should go back to the little piece that I read from, because I promised listeners that I didn't want to depress them.
Okay.
And let's make sure that we don't depress them.
Okay.
Okay. All right, so that sounds really lousy. Our weather is getting weirder, and we know that, and that's really, really upsetting. Now, where this all turns is when we think of, is let's look at water. When we hear about water and climate change, the connection between water and climate change, we hear about how in many places our water sources are stressed, and with rising temperatures that stress will become worse, and there will be like water shortages or companies trying to patent water, I don't know, just kind of to you know, to like to have water privatized and all these things. So that's very worrisome, and that is not wrong, okay? However, that's only part of the situation, because when we look at water and climate, water actually, it's not just that climate has an impact on water, water has an impact on climate. So water is a thermoregulator of climate. And in this chapter, I explore how we can make changes. We can restore the water cycle in a way that will further restore climate. And just there are these wonderful, wonderful scientists that I encountered who have written a very short book called The New Water Paradigm, Water for the Restoration of Climate. And anyway, when I read this, it totally blew my mind, and it's really exciting because it all makes sense. And it's not the story we're hearing.
Yeah, it's not the story we're hearing. There's so many stories we're not hearing.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And but these are they're just with environmental news, so much of it is bad, and I think a lot of people start to tune out. I know. I basically, just you asked how did I get into this material. One thing was a basic kind of existential question that I faced, and I think we all face, was this is really bad, what's happening to our planet. Now, I can just tune it all out and live my own little life because everything is fine, you know. Here, I live in Vermont, it's dandy, you know, I don't have to worry about what's going to happen in 50 years. Or I can engage with it as a journalist, and I chose to engage. So, and found a lot of these stories that really aren't out there. One other thing about this group of scientists is that they're foreign. They're Eastern European, they live in Slovakia and the Czech Republic. And I've also come to see that there are ideas out there in the world that might not come in to our media, that we're so big, we're such a, the U.S., we are such a huge news-producing entity that we often don't look outside as much as we should.
Yeah. You are listening to Writers on Writing. I'm with Judith Schwartz. Her book is Cows Save the Planet. I wanted to talk a little bit about the writing, and one thing I noticed that throughout was that you used fictional techniques in writing this book. For instance, you give a lot of physical details of many of the experts you visit with, or you do really interesting, colorful scene setting at the beginning of chapters, as you would a novel or a memoir. And I wondered if that was something you were consciously doing or going for, or if it's just, again, your writing style just came through, and it maybe doesn't matter what you would be writing, that that's how you write.
I think it was both. When I had that conversation with my publisher, and I was kind of helplessly saying, okay, now what? What do I do? Margot the Baldwin, the publisher, said, remember, you're telling stories.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why she gave me the book, encouraged me to reread the book, The Omnivore's Dilemma, because that's also told through stories. Basically, in that book, it's the story of four meals that are of various degrees of distance from the earth, you know, various degrees of industrialization. So I was aware of that, and that I needed to be telling stories. I was aware that this is that some of this material is technical. So I was very conscious to make sure that in each chapter there was someone's story I was able to tell.
Mm-hmm.
Someone through their eyes we would understand this particular idea or way of looking at the world.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was good. I loved it. I loved all of that about it because, there are topics, but how do we get pulled into the topics? You know, it's a story.
Right, and also I did come to know all these people, and it was interesting because most of the people, probably all of them in one way or another, have had trouble getting their ideas recognized because they are mavericks. They are challenging conventional ways of looking at things. And I think that interests me as a person because I admire that.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's always easier just to go along with what everyone else says.
Were there other books as well, other narrative nonfiction books that you either read or studied or hoped to emulate in some way? Or narrative nonfiction writers?
Wow. While I was working on this book, I did, most of my research was piecemeal, but if I told you the books that I read for information, you'd be very amused. Well, Darwin wrote a book about worms, and there's some really beautiful writing about that. I read, this is sort of silly, but I just knew that when I was dealing with the biodiversity chapter, that, you know, that I was going to be dealing with all these little soil microbes. I read the Horrible Science series. That's a series in the UK, and I so wish that they had it here in this country. Horrible History and Horrible Science. It's history and science with the naughty bits left in. They're comic books, and they make light of everything. But that's a way that kids learn, and that was certainly a way for me to read about microbes and not just let my get lost in the technical and scientific aspects.
Mm-hmm. And you have a wonderful foreword by Gretel Ehrlich, and I wondered how you got that, a couple of things, why you got it, and did you get it then, or did the publisher get it, and was it to sort of give credence to your book, because she is so famous in this way?
Yeah, I was aware from the beginning that an uphill battle is the fact that I'm not very well known.
Mm-hmm.
And but the thing with Gretel is it's interesting. It's kind of overdetermined in many ways. I mean, I know Gretel socially. She is a graduate of Bennington College, and she taught at Bennington College when my husband was teaching there. So we became friendly, and she has stayed at our home. And so there was already a basic relationship, and another local person she's very close friends with, so she's been in our circle, our social circle. But the other thing is that she has been aware of Alan Savory's work for decades. So that was the other thing that I told Chelsea Green. If anyone's going to write a biography or just a book about Alan Savory, it should be Gretel, because mm-hmm. she's spent a lot of time in Zimbabwe. She has applied holistic management approach on land that she had owned. So she knew this material really, really well. So it just made sense then on two levels. So the point about her knowing Alan, so it wasn't like, you know, hey, you, Gretel, you remember me? You stayed at my house and you write this. You know, it was like, all right, we're we're interested in this together. She's very busy. She just had a book out, so I was a little nervous about asking her, but she responded, and she responded to the book and loved it, and that all makes me really, really happy.
Mm. And the cover, I just love the cover, and I know you went through some trouble with the cover at a long ago point when it was first being turned into a physical book, when the book was underway. So can you say a few words about the cover, and are you happy with this one?
Oh, I'm very happy with it. Yeah, I don't think of myself as having a great design sense. You know, I certainly cannot create design, so that's something I just thought, oh, they'll do it, it'll all be fine, because I'd never been involved with creating a cover in any other books. Actually, that's not true. The one that I did myself, of course, I was very involved with,
mm-hmm.
and that was interesting. That was actually a really wonderful experience. But working with publishers, they'll know how. And it turned out, and I don't know because I really didn't talk to them about this, that the cover, that this was very, very hard to do this cover. They did a couple of iterations where there was just a cow, and I looked at them, and I didn't like the look of the cow. You know, like its, you know, mouth looked too big. You know, it looked funny. It looked mangy. You know, I just
that's cowism.
Yeah. I mean, there are an awful lot of cute cows out there, but actually, some even in my neighborhood. But whatever. I just didn't respond to the cow, and enough that it was. Like, oh no, I don't think I like this. So, something I don't like doing, which is asserting myself, I did. And my agent, Laura Gross, who's wonderful, she agreed, no, you've got to have a good cover. So we just kind of let it be known that we were going to be a little tough on this. And they hired I'm trying to see if her name is on this. I'm blanking on her name. Anyway, they hired a cover designer who was in their Kelly Blair, who was in their stable of, I guess this is how it works,
mm-hmm.
or at least that there are several, a publisher might work with several designers, and then the designers might, they'll ask a few designers to come up with a possible cover. I guess I just thought that they just landed there fully formed, but anyway, so this was the design that they came up with, and I really like it. And I wrote to the designer and said, thank you, which I wanted to do, because it is kind of an intimate thing, you know, like that this design that she created is like now just such a big part of my life.
I love it. I love it. It gives the sense of the book, too, in terms of the writing is lighter than you might expect with the topic.
Yeah.
And I think
yep.
that's important for people to know that you're not going to get bogged down in this heavy-duty science writing that you know, only scientists might want to read.
Right.
We're just about at the end of our time, and I wonder if you could, if there is anything that anyone has said to you, any advice perhaps that you've received along the way that has stuck with you and maybe, you know, in writing this book, you had to draw upon to get out of maybe dark places or holes that you found yourself in or moments when you didn't know really what to write next.
That is really, really tough. 'Cause as I look at it, the kind of the framework that I presented to the publisher is basically what I delivered. And I don't know whether, I can't think of anything. Of course I've gotten all sorts of advice along the way, but nothing stands out to me, I guess, because at this point I have written books and I've done this enough that when it was in a dark space, just, you know, oh my gosh, how am I going to write this stuff? How am I going to get this information in there? I just kept going.
Mm-hmm.
That's all. Just kept going and just said it will write itself.
So you had a structure. Yeah, you had a structure. And is that typically how you write? Do you typically have outlines so that you have something to stick with, whether it's an article or a book, so that when you might start puzzling over what's next, you look at your outline or synopsis?
You know, it's funny when you said that, an article or a book, because in some ways I'm better at conceptualizing a book than I am an article. I mean, sometimes it's easier just to know that there are all these pieces that need to be in there, whereas sometimes with an article, it's harder.
Mm-hmm.
It's funny, but it's mostly in my head. I'm not a great outliner. I'm a jotter of notes, but I'm not a great outliner. It's more that I almost see the structure in my head.
Yeah, you remind me of sometimes it's easier writing novels than short stories because who knows why, you know, there's more room to roam in a novel, maybe. And maybe it's like that with narrative nonfiction as opposed to articles, where in a book you have room to roam.
Right, and where different parts of it refer back to others, so you get a sense of building.
Mm-hmm. We are at the end of our time. Just any last words or advice for the listeners who may be working their way through a book-length project?
Wow, just stay curious. It's amazing what you'll find out there. I guess that's all I'd say, and keep asking questions.
And
someone's got to.
And give your website, too, where listeners can find more.
My website is judithdschwartz.com. And the publisher's Chelsea Green, and they have a really nice, actually, a dynamic website that they put a lot of news up.
Excellent.
News about environmental and political developments.
Well, thank you. Thank you so very much. This was a lot of fun, and I actually have more questions, so I might have to give you a call or email you or something.
Hey, no problem. You know where I am.
I know where you are. Thank you.
Thank you, Barbara.
That was Judith Schwartz. Her book is Cows Save the Planet and Other Improbable Ways of Restoring Soil to Heal the Earth, published by Chelsea Green. So we are at the end of our time. If you want to find out more about the show or listen to a podcast, this show will be podcast along with the others. Visit penonfire.com and you will find out much more. There, I will be back next week. And until then, stay curious, stay in the chair, and get some good writing done. Talk to you soon.